May it please the court, Mr. Mandel. The facts and the rule violations present in this attorney discipline case are undisputed and revolve around the serious neglect of a legal matter by respondent on behalf of his client, Michael Greenblatt. The neglect stretched for over a 5.5-year period and included active misrepresentation and deceit by the respondent toward his client regarding the status of a legal matter that he was retained to handle. While the misconduct appears to be an outlier in respondent's 13-year legal career, the protracted nature of the misconduct, as well as the fact that it involved deceit and misrepresentation, makes for a troubling case. During the relevant time period, respondent was employed as an associate in the litigation department at Armstrong Teasdale in St. Louis. In December 2009, Mr. Greenblatt retained the law firm to represent him with regard to a property dispute involving Mr. Greenblatt's neighbor. Respondent was assigned to handle the boundary dispute and any ensuing litigation that resulted. After reviewing the facts and discussing the matter with his client, respondent determined that a lawsuit should be filed against the neighbor to quiet title and to have the encroaching improvements removed from Mr. Greenblatt's property. By late December 2009, respondent informed his client that he was finalizing the petition and would soon file the lawsuit. The neglect and dishonesty commenced immediately thereafter. By February 2010, respondent falsely stated to his client that he had filed the lawsuit and was monitoring service of the petition. During the ensuing years, from 2010 until January 2016, respondent falsely stated to his client first that a lawsuit had been filed on behalf of Mr. Greenblatt, that he had obtained service on the defendant, and that the lawsuit was progressing, that he had prepared a motion for summary judgment in the lawsuit, that he was in the process of obtaining a trial date on behalf of Mr. Greenblatt in the case, that the court had granted the summary judgment motion, and that the defendant neighbor had appealed the trial court's granting of summary judgment in favor of Mr. Greenblatt. None of these statements were true. In addition, there were significant periods of time during 2015 when respondent failed to respond to inquiries from Mr. Greenblatt regarding the status of the lawsuit that Mr. Greenblatt thought was pending. In January 2016, respondent finally notified Mr. Greenblatt that he had lied regarding the lawsuit and that he had continued the deception for over 5 years. He also self-reported the misconduct to the Office of Chief Disciplinary Counsel. Respondent has admitted, and the panel correctly concluded, that respondent was guilty of professional misconduct over that period of 5 years that included violations of the following rules. 4-1.1, in that respondent failed to provide competent representation to his client. 4-1.3, in that respondent neglected the legal matter entrusted to him. 4-1.4, in that respondent failed to keep his client reasonably informed about the actual status of the litigation on which he was representing his client. And most significantly, 4-8.4C, in that respondent engaged in conduct involving dishonesty, deceit, and misrepresentation with regard to the legal matter. A majority of the panel recommended that respondent be suspended indefinitely with no leave to apply for reinstatement for 1 year, that the suspension be stayed, and that respondent be placed on probation. Informant rejected that recommendation. The ABA standards for imposing lawyer sanctions provides a baseline sanction analysis for the misconduct in this case. ABA standard 4.62 provides that suspension is appropriate when a lawyer knowingly deceives a client and causes injury or potential injury to that client.
What's the injury here?
Judge Draper, first of all, there's at least potential injury. In my view, there's actual injury. I think Mr. Greenblatt, the client, had a reasonable expectation that this lawsuit would be filed and resolved within a reasonable amount of time. He testified that he believed there was also damage in that. The lawsuit that was subsequently filed by successor counsel was filed after the 10-year adverse possession period of time when the neighbor might claim adverse possession ownership of the property.
Has he in the underlying lawsuit that we know of? Has he actually done that?
I am not aware that has actually occurred or the lawsuit has been resolved yet. I don't believe it has been, but that was the testimony. He also testified in response to Mr. Mandel's question that his lawyer told him that was unlikely to be a significant factor in the successor lawsuit. Nevertheless, that was the testimony of Mr. Greenblatt, and certainly there's at least an expectation that this case would have been resolved much quicker than it has been.
He billed and the firm was paid for services, at least some of which he never actually rendered. Is that correct?
That is correct, Judge Wilson. The Armstrong-Teasdale firm billed $662.50 for work purportedly done by the respondent with regard to this representation. Of that, $122.50 was for services not performed, namely checking on the, he billed for checking on the status of the summons and service, never happened, drafting an email to Mr. Greenblatt regarding that, telephoning Mr. Greenblatt regarding the purported summary judgment. None of those things ever actually happened. The firm, by the way, did reimburse Mr. Greenblatt soon after this was reported to them.
So
how do we, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, go ahead.
How do we consider that fact? It seems to me it could very well have been a separate count, a separate rule violation. It is at least an aggravator, would you?
I would agree that, I mean, it could have been a separate charge based on theft of the money of the client, the fact that monies were collected for work that was never done. I mean, when we get that type of case, that's 8.4C as well, for misappropriation of those funds. That was not done here, and it was, by the way, part of the self-report that Mr. Mandel made on behalf of his clients. He made an initial self-report and then supplemented it a few weeks later after he found out that, in fact, there had been some billings. So I think you're right. It could have been charged separately and could also be treated as an aggravator. That's correct, Judge.
But don't we look at self-reporting as a mitigator?
No doubt, Judge Russell. And it's a significant mitigator. If you look at the Bells case, the court made that clear, that self-reporting is a significant mitigator. He was clearly remorseful. He cooperated with our office and with the disciplinary system. And there are aggravators as well. I mean, the fact is this was a there was no selfish motive, by the way, another mitigator. By the same token, he has substantial experience in the practice of law. He graduated from law school in 2004, became licensed in 2004. There's a pattern of misconduct. There are multiple offenses. In my view, because of the protracted nature of the deceit over a five-year period, that is something that is a significant factor in determining to reject the panel's decision. In addition, I should also point out that the two cases that we cite in our brief, the Riza case and the Staub case, both involving deceit by an attorney towards the client regarding the status of the matters they were handling, Riza ended up with a suspension, Staub with a reprimand. 8.4C was not charged or found to have been violated in either of those cases cited in our brief. And so the additional factor of 8.4C and it's the fact that it lasted so long was that something I thought at least negated some of the mitigators that were clearly present in the case. There's no doubt that the conduct here was knowing by the respondent. He acted with conscious awareness of the nature, intent, and circumstances of his misconduct. He testified to the panel that he knew he was making a bad situation worse. And that bad situation continued and did get worse over a five-and-a-half-year period. The aggravators and mitigators I've already mentioned. In Missouri, there is a paucity of this type of case and of reported decisions involving outright deceit by a lawyer towards their client, and that's for good reason. It just doesn't happen that often. The Riza case I've mentioned was a suspension case, but also in Riza, I should also mention that Riza was also not cooperative with the disciplinary system and also was engaging in UPL under an administrative suspension, so he was practicing law while under administrative suspension, so that clearly was part of the suspension decision as well. The Staub case involved a court reprimand of an attorney who allowed a client's workers' compensation and Social Security case to be dismissed and then deceived the client regarding those dismissals. That was a reprimand. Nevertheless, again, as I just mentioned, neither of those cases were involving 8.4C violations, outright deceit or finding violations of that rule. Because of the lack of cases in Missouri, we cite in our brief three cases from other jurisdictions of more recent vintage.
On the Missouri cases you just cited, did those attorneys self-report?
I do not believe in either case, Judge Draper, were there self-reports in those cases. At least it was not mentioned as part of the written decision of the court, so I assume that did not happen. We cite three cases from other jurisdictions where courts dealt with this type of conduct. North Dakota case, Summers, involved 8.4C violation. The court found it and suspended the attorney for 6 months. In Colorado, the Eaton case, a 2-year suspension for a found violation of 8.4C. And then Kansas in 2010, the Bishop case, indefinitely suspended an attorney and found a violation of 8.4C for conduct very similar in terms of deceiving a client regarding the status of the legal matter that the attorney was handling.
The DHP recommended probation.
Correct.
And you rejected that recommendation.
Right.
In your brief, I am interested in an analysis of whether he is eligible for probation under 5.225.
I think that I would say yes, Judge Breckenridge. I'd say he is eligible. You know, it is a serious violation, and, you know, but nevertheless, I think it's the kind of violation that can be monitored by our office. I believe he's being monitored by his current firm. He works at Kaufman and Townsley.
Do you think he is unlikely to harm the public during the period of probation and can be adequately supervised?
I think that he's a candidate for probation, yes. I think that he can be supervised.
So if he fits the eligibility requirements and the DHP recommended it, why should we not consider probation?
Well, here is my problem with the DHP decision, Judge Breckenridge. If you read it, it pretty much tracks verbatim our information. No analysis by the panel as to why they found probation to be applicable. They simply quote the conduct, find the violations, note mitigators and aggravators, and decide that to recommend state suspension with probation. I find the lack of analysis, you know, if there had been more analysis, we might have even accepted it. I don't know. Nevertheless, there was none in that case. In addition, for the reasons I've stated, the fact that you've got Missouri cases without 8.4C findings, and this one going on for the length of time that it did.
The disqualification for probation is that the acts warrant disbarment. So the requirements for probation don't exclude a violation under 8.4C.
Well, that's correct. And I will say this, that under the ABA standard for disbarment for this type of conduct, it's clearly not applicable to this case. Under 4.61 of the ABA standards, it calls for disbarment when an attorney deceives a client and requires intent on the part of the lawyer to benefit himself. There's no indication here factually that there's any intent on the behalf of this respondent to benefit himself. So I don't think this is a disbarable case under any analysis under either the ABA standards or this court's case law.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Mr. Pressel gave you a very detailed setting out of the facts of this case. What's significant about that very detailed account of the facts of the case is that all of those facts originated from Mr. Valentino. Mr. Valentino, in his self-report, laid out exactly what Mr. Pressel has recited to you. As I stand here before you on this date, Mr. Greenblatt is not a complainant in this case. This case was started by a self-report, it continues by a self-report, and Mr. Valentino was very forthcoming, obviously, in the conduct that he felt was a violation that led us here today. Otherwise, I don't believe Mr. Pressel would have nearly been able to discover all the details and all the mental gymnastics that Mr. Valentino undertook. Judge Wilson, you asked a very good question about the billing. When we first self-reported, and Mr. Pressel alluded to this, Mr. Valentino's recollection was he didn't remember ever billing on this matter, which, given the nature of the work he described to the client at a firm like Armstrong, would be, you know, rather unusual. We double-checked. Mr. Valentino and I went back to Armstrong and got and asked for the billing records, and we discovered the $600-something, of which $122 was for alleged work that was not done. You know, I don't mean to minimize that that billing was done, but it was $122 for work that I would estimate, if I hired Armstrong to do, would have been more like, I should have asked Judge Price while he was here, but I would think that would be in the multiple of thousands had he been deceiving the client by billing. It also should be noted that it was Mr. Valentino that came forward to Mr. Greenblatt. It wasn't like Mr. Greenblatt discovered this on his own. This horrible situation could have continued, God knows, ad nauseum, had Mr. Valentino, who described...
There is a point where that house of cards is going to fall. You know, he had gotten him to appeal. Eventually, he's got to say the appeal is over. You know, what concerns me about your argument is that it seems to me the weight to be given to self-reporting has to decrease with the length of, or the seriousness, but maybe more important, the length of the misconduct.
And I think that's a very good point, Judge Wilson. Jonathan has described the mental anguish that he went through, the sleepless nights. We do not use his past medical history as an excuse for this conduct, but I think what he describes happens here is you have an individual who has really never failed before and never been in this kind of situation before. And the depression and the mental gymnastics that maybe I'll wake up tomorrow and this will be gone kind of feeds on itself. And highly successful people, you know, have that problem in accepting failure and accepting wrongdoing. As many of the members of this court are aware, I have a son who's in the military, and he's in a very specialized unit, and a good friend of his committed suicide after failing a course because he had never experienced failure before. High success individuals have difficulty with that. And I think Mr. Valentino had difficulty, and a year turns into two, Judge Wilson, and you got to remember that the contacts aren't daily. They seem to be very infrequent over that five-year period. Mr. Greenblatt was extremely patient, okay? But a year turns into two, and you're waking up in the middle of the night, and you're thinking, oh, my God, what have I done here? How do I get out of it? And then the next call comes in, and there's no justification for it. That's why Mr. Valentino eventually broke and cracked and self-reported first to his employers and then to the Mr. Greenblatt. Mr. Greenblatt, as you can see by the DHP testimony, was so concerned about Mr. Valentino's mental state when Mr. Valentino called him and Mr. Valentino was driving the time that Mr. Greenblatt urged him to pull over.
I interrupt. I mean, this is a sympathetic case. I get that. But that's what concerns me, that it took 5 years to crack. I mean, what if the case had settled 3 years in? We wouldn't be here. And that's what concerns me. He would have gotten away with it. And that's what concerns me long term about this case.
Judge Powell, yes. Yes. Okay. Had the case settled, maybe we would never have known. Who knows? You know, we don't know what goes on behind closed doors in law firms all over this state, whether things like you're describing happen or not.
Well, it shouldn't.
It shouldn't.
And I think it's important that we send a message that it shouldn't happen.
We are not here defending the conduct. Okay, this is not a question where I am asking this court to assess whether there was a rules violations or not. We freely admit that. Okay, and when we are, and Mr. Valentino is here today, we are sincerely ashamed. I think we are sincerely sorry. Those apologies have been expressed to Mr. Greenblatt over and over again. And there's just, you know, I'm not up here to explain the conduct. What I'm up here to do is look at the members of this court and say to you, we have a lawyer who was about 5 years in at the time of this happened, in a very high-pressure law firm, such as Armstrong, made a series of mistakes over a long period of time about one matter. Evidently, all the other matters he was handling were handled to the satisfaction of himself.
Or they settled, and we don't know about it.
Well, but that's true about me, too, Your Honor. Okay, we don't know each other personally, but I've been doing this 40 years, and you know, there may be things that I've done that you don't know about. Okay, I would hope not, but okay, but that's true of all of us. So what we are here to do today is decide on Mr. Valentino's punishment, and that's what we're here to do.
Well, you know, our primary role is to protect the public, and so how can we be assured that this type of action won't occur again?
Again, crystal balls, or you know, if I was in that business, I wouldn't be standing here. I'd be winning the lottery somewhere. But Mr. Valentino's entire legal career, both during this horrible incident and especially since, indicate that that's not likely. What we have agreed to by the DHP, the recommendation of the DHP, is a fairly rigorous probation proceeding. Okay, a probation proceeding that I'm willing to represent to the court, as I have on occasions past when I've argued this to you. I am happy, having gotten to know Jonathan, I would be happy to serve as his probation monitor if Mr. Pratzel and the OCDC found that to be appropriate. And I have never had a client who deviated from the probation terms and had not completed probation successfully. But I think, Judge Russell, in direct response to your question, we have a respondent with no prior history of discipline. There's no evidence, as Mr. Pratzel stated, that he had a selfish or dishonest motive.
I don't understand no dishonest motive. When you lie to your client, that seems to me there's a dishonest motive.
I think what the rule means when they talk about that, when the ABA standard 932 speaks about that, is a personal profit dishonest, right. I'm going to enrich myself motive. Right. Obviously, lying to somebody is a dishonest act.
I get that. I'm concerned about our obligation to protect the integrity of the profession. It seems like to me one thing that we ought to emphasize is that lawyers ought to tell the truth, which includes good news and bad news, to their clients. This is really at the root of what we, tell young lawyers when they start out. If you'll just be honest with your client, that will keep you out of trouble for the most part. And try to communicate regularly and stay on top of your cases.
Nobody feels stronger about that, Judge Fisher, than myself. I've stood before you many times and expressed the same thoughts. In this particular case, though, do we want to send the message to young members of the bar that you make one mistake and you're gone? That doesn't mean that we don't discipline them. Okay, but are we really to the point in the profession where we are not going to be tolerant of human failings to the degree, if you steal money from a client, there's no tolerance for that if you do. But are we really going to get to the stage in this profession where we say to somebody, you make one mistake and you're gone? I have spoken to this court and many others on where we are in this profession in terms of the business pressures that are put on young lawyers, the work pressures, and I don't think we're there. I think we send the appropriate message to the young lawyers of the bar by doing what the DHP suggested. My initial response was, and Mr. Pratzel, he cited the stat case. It doesn't support what he's recommending to do here, because Mr. Stat had a prior disciplinary record. He was dishonest to a client. That client suffered some consequences from that action, and this court reprimanded him. That was my initial feeling about the appropriate punishment here, was a reprimand. But when the DHP made their recommendations, Mr. Valentino instructed me to accept them. Okay? And so we are here today. I think we protect the public by issuing a suspension and then probation, because if I'm a young lawyer and I'm reading the Bar Journal, and I see that, I'm thinking to myself, I don't want to go there. Okay, so I think that's accomplished. In terms of protecting the public, I don't think Mr. Valentino is a problem to the public. He's been performing well by the testimony of his new employer at the law firm he's at. He monitors, he's reported in. If he's placed on probation, he will continue to do that. And I would be very, very shocked, and I probably won't be around here in 20 years, although some of my colleagues are. I would be very shocked if this court ever sees or hears from Mr. Valentino again.
Now, there was some allegations.
That's my personal assessment.
Yeah, thank you. I'm sorry. Excuse me. There were some allegations of depression on Mr. Valentino's part, although he said that the depression had nothing to do with his lies to the client. Are there any steps that have been taken to protect him from future depression?
Mr. Valentino has undergone counseling, Your Honor, and Mr. Valentino refused to assess this behavior to his depression. I think where it contributed to the problem, which is in the area that Judge Fisher and Judge Powell, you're most concerned with, which is in his dealing with it and allowing it to go on and kind of hoping that something would happen to save him from this, what he had created himself, this personal hell, as he described it very well in the DHP, that he underwent. And I think the depression factored into what I was saying about successful people and dealing with setbacks, and I think it made him, for a long time, until it got critical mass, and that took 5 years, unfortunately, until it got critical mass, it made it difficult for him to deal with it. But when he did deal with it, he dealt with it like a stand-up person. Okay? As I said, most of the facts that Mr. Pratzel has related to you, if not all of them, that Mr. Pratzel has related to you, that this court may find so disturbing, came from Mr. Valentino himself. He's the one who laid that out for you, okay? I don't mean to say that self-reporting is the end-all and means-all here. I really don't. But if you combine it with the other things that the ABA uses about mitigating factors, you look at the no disciplinary record, the personal emotional problems I already addressed, full disclosure and cooperative attitude towards the disciplinary board, fully cooperating with the process, imposition of other penalties and sanctions. Mr. Valentino lost his job. This has been fairly well known in the legal community. We had four lawyers from Armstrong Teasel here this morning arguing another case. They know Mr. Valentino. He's experienced shame and remorse in front of that. He suffered personal financial hardship when he lost his job, and remorse. And he, you know, I don't know what else he could do to express his remorse other than what he's done. The last thing I'd like to address in the minute I have left is that Mr. Greenblatt, fortunately, Judge Powell, fortunately, this lawsuit was not materially affected. Mr. Greenblatt testified in the DHP that his lawsuit is proceeding, that his lawyer told him that the delay probably didn't have any effect on the outcome. And this is not a situation where Mr. Valentino's deception caused Mr. Greenblatt to lose his cause of action or to suffer financially, although that's not, you know, the financial suffering, I don't think is a means-all. Okay, so, you know, we have a situation here where, what are we going to do with this young man? Are we going to cast him out? I mean, a year of suspension for a lawyer his age really means that he's done. Or are we going to work with him and give him a chance? I think that all the facts in this case indicate that the DHP was probably right on. I would ask this court to follow their recommendation to issue a suspension for 1 year, with no leave to reapply, but place him on probation, suspend it, place him on probation for a period of time. The DHP recommended 1 year. If the court wanted to make it longer, I don't have a problem with it. I think 1 year would suffice. And as I indicated, I would volunteer to Mr. Pratzel to undertake the role of mentor and supervisor of the probation, as I had in other cases. Thank you.
Just a few points. The issue of depression has kind of dropped in and dropped out of this case. The respondent mentions it in his answer to the information. It was referenced in the testimony. He says that the depression manifested itself in his representation of Mr. Greenblatt. He did not blame his misconduct on the depression, but it kind of is on the outskirts of this case. So I just want to make clear to this court that should have no consideration in terms of what sanction is imposed. In order for that type of mental disability to be considered a mitigator, 5.285 has very specific requirements, none of which were met in this case.
But is it relevant to going forward on his ability to handle cases in the future?
I think that the fact that he's undergoing counseling and apparently will continue to do so is a factor the court can consider in regards to probationary terms, perhaps, if you find that to be appropriate. My point is simply that it's kind of been on the outskirts of this case, and I've never really been sure of whether they're asking that be treated as a mitigator, and I can just ask you not to do that because it's, none of the requirements for that have been met. Mr. Mandel mentions that successful people don't like to fail. Successful people need to bite the bullet at some point, need to come forward, tell their clients. Successful lawyers need to tell their clients when something has gone wrong in a case, and specifically in a case where it was their own neglect that caused possible harm to the client, or actual harm, depending on how you look at it. In this case, it went on for more than five and a half years, and that is not, to me, can be laid at the feet of the fact that he was a successful person that couldn't withstand a failure. It was his own failure to come forward to Mr. Greenblatt that caused this problem to begin with. A couple of mentions by Mr. Mandel regarding that all the specific allegations of our information and of our case were based on the self-report. The self-report can be found at pages 80 to 84 of the appendix. He made a self-report, fairly thorough, but you should know that the specific allegations of the information and the specific findings by the panel were the result of Mr. Greenblatt turning over to me emails and correspondence about this thick that had those emails included. So every quote from an email in the information and in the panel's decision came from Mr. Greenblatt, not from the respondent. However, he did make a self-report that was fairly thorough.
From your investigation and from the record, do you have a belief that this is an aberration? There were some questions asked about, you know, can we believe there are other cases? And there is some evidence to support it is an aberration and is a one-time big mistake. What is your opinion?
I don't disagree with that, Judge Breckenridge. As I said at the outset, it's an outlier in his legal career. He's been licensed and practicing since 2004. There is no disciplinary history. You could characterize it as an aberration. It's just that it was so deceiving, so deceitful to the client, and for such a long period of time that I really expected that they were going to come forward with a 5.285 mitigation defense based on some sort of mental disability. Who does this? It is a house of cards. It's never going to have a good ending, and that just never happened in this case. He ascribed it to cowardice and a fear of being fired by his law firm. Well, you know, that's exactly what happened. As soon as he made the law firm aware of it, they separated from each other. So we ask for a 6-month actual suspension. Thank you.